It's time we did some more foundation work understanding the look and feel of DNA. In the 1940s, for instance, the average person, if you said DNA, or you're looking to a movie which someone mentioned DNA, would pick this out as something out of place. But now it's very much in place in our culture, and we use it all the time. And it's got a meaning and imagery which doesn't actually square up with what actually DNA looks like or feels like, or some of the incredible numbers and dimensions of DNA, and how that squares at the moment. So our culture has gone off in one direction, and all too often we teach our science based on this cultural understanding. Everyone knows what DNA is. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. DNA, deoxynucleic acid. And if you ask anyone, DNA is the blueprint for life. So if you've got a cat or a dog, they've got the DNA of a cat or the DNA of a dog. Or if someone is you don't like, they've got the wrong DNA. Or if someone's diseased, there's a problem. If they've got cancer, there's a problem with their DNA. And commercial companies, I'm just giving you the background here. Commercial companies will say services in our DNA, so we have actually got a set of written instructions, basic philosophy, and that's written somehow, and that's our DNA. So a lot of people have the view of what DNA is. It's this sort of fundamental background programming which determines what something is, and it's the fundamental value of something. So we're going to go a bit more in, and I think other people would say recognize the double helix. This is two strands with the rungs, a ladder which is twisted, sort of like a spring, that is, there's one spring and there's another spring and there's rungs in between. People recognise that. Another thing people recognise is the X, sort of X with long legs, I think it's chromosomes, chromids. We're not going to go into too much detail about what's actually inside DNA and how it actually works, and we're just going to go in this podcast on some of the features of DNA, the mechanical features of DNA, which are sort of missing in your background as you start to study how DNA converts into a protein. So proteins are the machines that proteins and actually little strips of something called RNA, which are pre-proteins, they're the machines that go out and start to chomp away nanomachines inside your cells, which actually build you, and you are a result of slightly different operating nanomachines producing different chemicals and stuff like that. So the nanomachines then forge chemicals which forge you, and so all of that information is stored. It doesn't come out of anywhere. It's out of chaos. It's the basic building blocks put together and assembled using the blueprint of DNA. A lot of people have heard this before. And there's basic types of bases. DNA can be made up of fundamental points, and this forms a code. Now, people understand decoding DNA. So people's another thing is people look for DNA evidence at a crime scene. So a single cell can be multiplied up, amplified. So previously in Sherlock Holmes, you had a microscope of a single clue. And so what we can do nowadays, it's getting a bit beyond what people understand. They think, or people look at the DNA itself. No, we can now multiply that DNA. So say if you have a little bit a Sherlock Holmes clue, he could actually take it into a big clue multiplier and actually grow a big size version of the clue to look at. He wouldn't need his magnifying glass to hook around. So people got a big view of DNA, especially from crime scenes. The DNA evidence is the clincher. It's the exact scientific evidence of what's going on. We're not going to go into that here. We're going to describe a little bit more what DNA looks like or is, and start to get some of the facts and figures into your your understanding. Now, not all life forms have technically DNA, because not all life forms have nucleuses, but they still have the DNA molecule. Bacteria have DNA in rings, similar to, I suppose, hula hoops or rings. It's just a ring of DNA. It's a helix, but in a big floppy ring. So archaic cells and bacteria have DNA in different forms, but namely in rings. And eukaryotic cells have the DNA in a much more unwound string. This will be surprising for you. It's not coiled up in a dense coil all the time, as you see in that X shape. It's in a held in a little package, unwound in a string, there. Whereas the bacteria, eukaryotic cell, is an archaic cell which has become a slave master. The slave parts of your cell, the organelles. Some of the organelles are not programmed or produced by the central package of DNA. A lot of the machinery in the cell owe its origin from the DNA, but there are some slave bacteria in your cell which are faithfully reproduced as bacteria going forward. And so inside your cell you have something called mitochondria, which is the eat sugar to cell food. So your cells operate on cell food called ATP. So you feed your cell, actually feeds the bacteria, goes up to the bacteria inside your cell called mitochondria, feeds it some sugar, and it produces ATP, which is the energy source for all the nanomachines produced by your DNA. Hope you can follow it so far. But inside that mitochondria are rings of DNA, because it produces in parallel to your cell. You've got two forms of life in each cell. You've got two forms of life. You've got the cell, mother cell, and you've got the slaves. And so it's sort of like a upstairs, downstairs. The rich people are up the top, really sophisticated, doing all these amazing things, and down in the scullery is just little bits of bacteria which live a horrible life, and they can only survive if, when the cell is moving house, reproducing or doubling up, they double up as well. And so you've got this two strands of life. This is something which obviously is not communicated in school, and I suppose as you do biology, you'll be able to look at it. So it's mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA is different from the nucleic DNA. And we're going to hop into the second set of DNA, nucleic DNA. So that DNA is a microfilament, technically a microfilament. That is a very, very thin string. And it's made up of a lead and a lag strand. So it's a DNA double helix made out of two strands. And we may as well go through it. There's ATCG. I must admit, my pronunciation of all these things I don't have at the top of my head. But A and T go together. As you can remember, A and T are drawn with straight lines, and they've got two hydrogen bonds. So if you can look at the bottom of the A, there's two ends of that. And so the A is a type of base, the T is a type of base. C and G go together, they're three bonds, hydrogen bonds, and your DNA is made up of a sequence of something called codons. So that's three bases in little clumps. Each codon represents is translated into a particular one of 20 amino acids. So your line in your DNA by groups of three is translated into, say, if you've got 30, a sequence of DNA starting 30 long, we're going to have to add a little bit to it. There's also a start and stop button, so let's call it 32. So I've got a start, 30, and a stop in my DNA sequence, and that means I've got a 30 length in my 30 code points to... I'm not going to tell you about the RNA and all that type of stuff. It'll overload your brain. That corresponds to a protein. And of that 30, given that it takes three base sequences to specify an amino acid, that particular protein is 10 amino acids long. And a protein, like the DNA, is a long string, of course. This string is origamied up into all these fantastic shapes, opening jaws, scissors, anything you want. I dare say, almost a tabletop or something like that, sort of like furniture. Sort of like IKEA gone mad, except you don't have it in flat packs, you have it in long strings with fold here, and here you've got these fantastic devices called proteins. Of course, the proteins have mechanical properties, but they also have chemical properties. And it's sort of like these designer chemicals. And the proteins act sort of like these beautiful factories to process and encourage just the chemical reactions we want. The chemical reactions build our life, fill us with different messenger proteins called hormones, and everything else in ourselves. So we've got the strands, the lead and lag strands come together with the bases. So a base unit is the base acid hooked to a salt and a phosphate. And I say salt, it should be sugar. A sugar phosphate is sort of the backbone, and the base itself is the actual, I suppose, little chemical unit which goes in there. But the base little unit itself never floats around. It's actually always locked into a phosphate sugar unit. So if you can imagine, the phosphate and sugar is like your Lego block, and the base on top of it, base hanging out, is the sort of the jewel, the feature of it. And so what happens is that the DNA is constructed by adding a phosphate sugar selected base unit and clicking it onto each other. So it doesn't add a phosphate, then add a sugar, and then find a base which fits in it. No, these sugar and phosphate and base come as pre-assembled subunits to clip together, prefab. So the prefab, the molecule. So this forms a strand, and as the strand grows, and it's fantastic. We could talk for an hour. The way that it grows, it replicates, is just absolutely amazing. We're not going to cover that this time. Just needless to say that A and T go together, and C and G go together. And so what they found is that they figured this out pretty quickly. You got your DNA, and they were able to isolate four chemicals, the A, the T, the C, the G. There's four components, but they always noted that the A and T were always the same amount. So if I got some DNA and it was some special DNA, I would get, say, 5 milliliters of the A, 5 milliliters of the T, and then I would get 7 milliliters of the C and 7 of the G. And they scratched their head and they said, oh, there's a law here that A is always equal to T in terms of mass, and G is always equal to C. in terms of the mass or the molar mass or the number of molecules, and therefore they got that first clue that A goes with T or T with A and C with G or G with C, that they're all paired together. Of course, only later did we realise that there's a key of hydrogen bonds which go together to determine this. And so this gives you codons, proteins, and you can imagine that your DNA produces it. So this is a filament, and this filament goes away, and a bit like processing power, your DNA has to, on several cases, in order to operate, it operates in a massively parallel way. And we'll have to start off. I know a lot of you have the view that the DNA is in these. Often they're shown as 23, but there's actually 46 little of these little X's of different sizes, and often they're striped, often shown inside a cell as the DNA. And that's DNA basically a snapshot of DNA. It's sort of like you're going on a holiday and you're boarding on a ship, and they photograph you at the point of time that you're going in a ship. And so this is a snapshot of DNA at one point in its life cycle. It's ready to go on a new adventure. But if you rewind it, that DNA itself is all packaged up, ready to travel. And in the work at home DNA, that little strand is unbound. So the time you see it in that X shape, that's carrier type. Yeah, I'm just trying to think of the word. Carrier type there's a special name for a picture of DNA when it's in that shape and it's all sorted out. And mechanically what happens is that DNA does not go in a beautiful order. Each cell of you, this is going to shock you, each cell of you is a mum and a dad. So each individual cell in you contains 23 mum and 23 dad. you're not mixed up. And the mum supplies a mix of your grandmum and granddad. It's a spliced up mix, and your dad forms a mix of a Frankenstein mix of your paternal grandfather and grandmother. It's pretty spooky. It's a DNA mix. When I say a DNA mix, when I say a Frankenstein mix, I do mean a Frankenstein mix. That is, you've got your grandfather's DNA and your grandmother's DNA, and it's like a spooky Frankenstein movie. There's a hand from your, or not really a hand, but a section of your father's DNA stitched on to your grandmother's DNA, and then that's handed by your mother into you. Try and get your mind around it. You'll have to read up about it. So there's 46 of these little X's, but when it's operating inside of you, those little X's, that's its travel form. And it's a bit more spooky. It's its travel form just as it's ready to duplicate and ready to go off on a journey in two brand new cells, duplicate cells. Having had lived its life as a cell, cell is now going to divide into two, and just the moment it's divided into two, it's as if the 46 are coming, 46 people are there, and they've caught them just as they're duplicating. The DNA duplicates, so there's 46 little strips of DNA, and at a particular point in time, just as they're beginning to pair off and duplicate, they're just, you can imagine CGI of someone, a different version of you just going out, and you're attached, your head's gone out, your legs are gone out, and you're still attached to the belly. You're like Siamese twins, and they're just ready to separate, and flash, taken a photograph of you, and that's when it's an X. But the rest of the time, before it's an X, it's just you, so it's a strip. And each of those strips inside your cell, when they're the workaholic time of the cell, the cell's doing its normal stuff, it's not going on holidays, getting ready to duplicate. This DNA is uncoiled. So let's see. Imagine you've got string, and normally string has three levels of twine. Let's imagine it's got two levels of twine. And what you do is you get the twine, make it, coil it up. Imagine it's a sort of a fairly stiff coil. Coil it up around your finger, so it's a coil. So that's a double helix. It is made into a helix. And that helix is basically like a spring. Now, if you then rotate that spring into a spring, again, you can actually make that spring, that fairly thick spring, into another spring and rotate it around and around and around. And that's what you picture. So what you're pitching is a double helix, which is made into a helix, which is made into a helix. So it's not sort of it's a helix of a helix of a double helix. That's what the DNA that you look at. But normally, that's packaged ready to go. So say if someone said, I don't know what your name is out there, but let's call you. Yep, I have to finish now. Yes, son. Filaments of DNA, a double helix, so you can get some string with just some twine and just pull it apart and just get two to replicate this. Then you put it in one helix, and so it's like a spring, and then you wind that spring up again. Oh, I think it's even triple wound into springs. It's a pretty amazing spring process. I'll have to look at it. So it's coiled up, but super coiled. I think they actually called it super coiled. Got up. Oh, there's a huge bird fight happening just in front here. Always action, as long as they don't attack me. So these particular birds can actually become quite aggressive. Okay, getting back to it. So that's your DNA, 46 pieces, and I think I told you that they were a Frankenstein, that you are a Frankenstein of your four grandparents actually spliced and cut together. So your DNA is a patchwork. the same DNA, piece of DNA, but it's actually cut across to it. And it's amazing the number of mistakes you see in DNA pictures, DNA sculptures even. It's a DNA sculpture and there's mistakes, and I just blows me away. I think it's in a park. There's all these DNA replications, and people think that karyotypes are a major way. But when DNA is actually used in your cell, it's all spun out. So I'm just going to try and give you a visual picture. So imagine those karyotyped super wound, super helix wound up pieces of DNA as 46 little, I don't know, of that shape, but size of hundreds of thousands or millions and billions dropped into your glass of water, and they're floating around. And so it's pictured at that point and it's all mixed up. And so in order to get you that ordered family shot, it's like it's photoshopped to look like that. Indeed, they do photoshopped, and it's not normally striped. They have special dyes which give the actual chromosomes the stripes. Now, chromosome means coloured, so they can actually colour the chromosomes, and it actually allows them to pick. They're all different X. All the X's are different shape, but so they can put them together in pairs. They'll look, and they'll have a certain like different team jerseys on them, you can able to identify what they are and put them together in pairs and see some sort of major genetic diseases. One, if there's an extra one there, or it is general, or there's can be multiple X's. chromosome, or I can't remember, 13, various ones that can look down a microscope and at this supercoiled state. But when your DNA is out in its working function, it's all spread out. Say you're doing an assignment and you're researching, you'll spread out all your sheets of paper and just go through it and have a look. And that's the way your DNA normally is. And I've got you back to the pattern of it, imagining a glass. Now, imagine they all uncoil, and we've put a magic glow dye on each individual one. Your your glass will fill up completely with different regions. All, rather than being tight, it'll be all a big region of your glass, zones of your glass, like different coloured jellies in there. And as you cut in with your spoon, you will cut into different of 46, or really 23 individual, or I don't know. We won't go into it a bit more. This is a little bit complicated to think about the different types of DNA, chromosomes, chromeds. I really can't pronounce them. Going there, but we've got your jelly that you cut in. So somehow it's this magic jelly, and there are little zones of red and green. And to tell you that you're in a zone if it's unwound out. Now, when it's unwound out, so it's not in its supercoil, it's all just spread out all over the place, it means that enzymes can go in and access every single gene at the same time. It can't. It's not limited access, it's massive access. It's massive parallel data array, so it can produce thousands of proteins instantaneously in parallel. Now, when it's replicating, it replicates from the top and the bottom of each X, and so that's a factor of 2, then a factor of for each one of those X's, it replicates each one of those X's at the same time. So an X is a replicated version, so you've got the left part of the X gets it produces a right side of the X, and that's its replication. But it does that doubly for the top and bottom of the X, and also 46 times at the same time. So you get a factor of 100 replication speed just by breaking up your DNA. And that's, in fact, why the DNA is broken up into little bits, because it's sort of like a quad core. Well, this is a 100-core replication speed. It allows rapid replication by a factor of 100 by breaking it up into little pieces. And there's probably other reasons behind it as well. But getting back, you know, when it's not in that supercoiled state, it's all expanded. So imagine your string not supercoiled. I've just got to remember, just visualising, I can see it's coiled many, many times. I think it's just coil an incredible number of times to build something as big that you can see under a microscope. It's not under no normal microscope that you could see it, because people are struggling to barely see the nucleus, and to see it, it's probably an electron microscope to see it. Now, of course, when I've said magic coloured jelly, and you've got it in these your jelly cup full of each section of your jets, every part of your cup is completely full, and they're broken into zones of different colours. Now, we can actually do that in real life by the power of amazing science. We can genetically modify the genes such that fluorescent dyes attach to them. That's pretty spooky. I don't know whether the thing with the dyes on it can actually make a living animal, but we can actually make glowing animals by modifying the genes, but we can actually modify the gene itself so that DNA attaches glowing dyes to it. So each chromosome has various sequences of DNA. So we say for a particular sequence of DNA, we can attach a dye which will look for that sequence. And so for, say, on chromosome number 10 of those, 22 plus 1 6... times a mum and a dad gives you 46 chromosomes, and look, there's a little bit of mind-bending twisting there, but say if we took number 10, we could make number 10 red, because we can identify bits of 10 which we want to make red, and then we can make number 11 green, and we can actually make it glow in the dark. So you imagine you've got your glass, there, your little cup with the jelly in it, and we can actually, it appears, you can vaguely tell there's different regions. If you switch on the light, it will suddenly glow all green and different colours. Now, I've forgot the Wikipedia. If you just go to the Wikipedia page of DNA in a cell, or pick it up, you'll see a lot of the karyotypes, but you'll see these little blobs with all these different colours in it. And most of the time, the DNA is in this shape. So it's like this beautiful jewel of different areas, and we can actually physically make it up. So this is one of the things where science in the lab meets science in the textbook. We can actually produce a model of real life, which has been designed for display in a textbook, so you can see the different groups of DNA. And so most of the time, for most of the cells, you will look, the DNA will be as that dispersed thing, because most of the time the DNA is getting up in the morning, doing its work, continuing day after day. It's only in replication day does it all pack up, supercoil, and get ready to reproduce. So at that time, that special day, that one day a month, it's going to replicate normally, you would see it all pull together. So your little cup, I'm just giving you a model so you can imagine in your head, but if you looked under a microscope, a cup, all the coloured regions would concentrate into one really bright little speck. As it's supercoiled up, and it's all be floating in there, as you'll be able to see 46 little specks rather than 46 big regions, there'll be little specks. And so, say if you had 30 cups on any particular day, you would have most cups there with the big regions inside it coloured, not in bands but in little chunks, and will come together. It's sort of like three dimensions. Say if you had another example is, say if you had different colours of Play-Doh, and you're putting it together, you roll it up into balls, and mum comes along, you have to pack it up. So you all scram it in, so red, white, black, and thing, and you all just packed it all together, and then it would produce what it looks like inside a cell, all these different large areas. and of course, if you... Unfortunately, if you mashed it up, it would all go into each other. But amazingly, DNA doesn't do that. It always stays in its localized region. And so when it's all expanded, it's there. So if you can do, I think a Play-Doh is another, or I don't know what you call it, overseas, or different colored regions of dough or bottling clay of different colors put together, there'll be different regions, three-dimensional, making it a three-dimensional thing. And if you slice it, you'll get these different regions if you look through, but three-dimensionally, it's in these different regions. And we're back to our 30 cups once a month. One of the, on that particular day, on that's birthday, it's going to replicate to make two cups, and you'll take the special cup away. So it'll all go clear except for these tiny little spots ready to go. And so if you've got a normal reproducing cell tissue, there'll only be 1 in 100, 1 in 200 cells which will be in this orientation. Of course, if it's carcinogenic, it's replicating far too fast, its rate of replication is too much, you will see a majority of cells, or half the cells, a third of the cells, rather than 1 in 30, will be in this carrier-type state. So this is how people in labs with stains and various things can get biopsy tissue, prepare the slide and have a look, and if they can see the replication rate and see if it's carcinogenic. Very interesting thing. But if you don't explain to people that they're operating with this textbook version of reality, they don't have access to it. So again, this replication state is just this instant. So what happens is that it goes from occupying a large volume of the nucleus right down to this double helical thing. So you can imagine it as a long sock-like object, and then it starts replicating, and it will replicate into two with sort of cable tied in the centre, like a little wire wrap holding the two together, and then of course it has to go do a dance, so equal amounts go off an equal side, so you get two new daughter cells being produced from the old cell, which I suppose gets destroyed and harvested to produce two daughter cells. And so that's DNA. So DNA itself normally is this unwound, unruly string. And just how long is this string? So if I was to connect and arrange each length of string is between 10 and 26. I'm just going off the top of my head. Oh, I don't know if that's correct. It could be a 30 in there. Length being... Oh, I'm going to have to finish yet again. So this, I'll do this in a third, in three pieces. So on to here, we're going to go in the next episode, is how long is a piece of string? And the pause will be a long pause for me broadcasting, but a short pause for you listening. In the meantime, is how long is your DNA in each cell in your body? And if you had all your DNA, how long would that be? And I'm prepared to place a bet that you probably won't even come close to knowing the length of your DNA. Just my bet. Remember, a cell is pretty small. How much string could you fit in a really tiny cell? A cell so small you can even see it. I'll get back to you to talking about that next time. I'll continue after this. I'm back again, and welcome to the third installment of discussion of what DNA really is like. Now, to you, this will appear continuous, but to me, I've been interrupted once. I don't mind it, to fix lunch and then take children off to an AFL football match, and this is the next day in the morning. I didn't get any time to work on it since then. I suppose for a professional podcast, this would be an absolute crime, but this is just a realistic podcast from a teacher trying to give more information to his peers. So we were doing DNA, and I tried to give a simple version of DNA and pointing out that inside the nucleus, when the DNA is hanging out ready to do its stuff at millions of sites simultaneously, it's completely spun out. It's completely uncoiled in big globs, and the globs are in regions such that if you were to colour them, and indeed you can colour them, they'd appear as large regions, as if you'd got different groups of Play-Doh, different colours of Play-Doh, and squished it together in a ball. We'll discuss that a little bit further. There's sort of two things I want to do. Is what is the length of that DNA if you got a pin for one piece of DNA and just stuck it. Now, obviously, there's 46 pieces, 20 automes. Automes, I think that's the way. They're the numbered pieces and then the lettered X and Y pieces of the chromosomes. So it's broken up that way. But if you stuck it all together, how long would it be? And the surprising answer to that is 2 meters long. That is much longer than you are. And that's sort of hard to imagine, that each tiny cell in you contains 2 meters of DNA. And there's, you can imagine that 2 meters stuck in an absolute small little ball is almost explosive inside there. And in fact, if you do pop the nucleus, the DNA just springs out like guts. Blah! So the nuclear shell with its pores, little holes in it, it's got a very important features. And it's actually almost an energy that is a sort of a high-tension, almost a bomb, so to speak. And indeed, the DNA does explode. We'll discuss that a bit later on. We have the thing of 2 meters. That's hard to comprehend, I think, or I suppose it's easy enough for someone, a student, just 2 meters, that's all right. Then we say, well, look, in your body there's more than one cell. What would be the total length of your DNA? People can calculate, and they start to, I suggest in the class, have a guess at the number of cells in the human body. And we'll, and obviously someone will quickly Google, they always do that. And the number which has been calculated and quoted is, wait for it, 37.2 trillion cells. Now that's in scientific notation 10 to the 12 or million cells. That's an awful lot of cells. So the answer is 2 by 37.2 trillion kilometres. Now, trillion metres. Now, just to work this out, and I had sort of worked this out a few years ago, and I've seen it worked out on the net. I haven't actually seen a correct calculation. I'll discuss the calculation I've seen previously, but you can also calculate it on the net by putting 37.2 E12 space X for times 2 divided by the distance to from here to the sun is 150 million kilometres. So a million kilometres is a billion metres, is 1,000 kilometres in a metre. 1,000 millions is a billion. So that's 150 E9, and I think even at this stage the fast Google things will not be waiting for you to press enter. They'll have the number calculated as you type beneath, and you'll find the surprising answer is that the total length of DNA in your body is equivalent to close on 500 trips to the sun. From here to the sun, and you can do some other calculations that it would take millions of years for you to walk the entire length of your DNA, and you can do other calculations that the length of DNA of the human race will stretch easily to the next couple of galaxies. So it's a staggering number, and it's worthwhile to do. I don't know what I think there is an educational value in getting students to do the calculations of it, because I think they sort of that's a sort of a number that they can remember, 500 trips to the sun. Now I said I would mention the other internet sources. I've seen 5 trips to the sun, 70 trips to the sun, there's another 70, but just putting in the numbers for yourself, that's what what I get, and I somehow believe it's I sort of trust my own calculations. 37.2, I was disappointed by 37.2 because I was really hoping for 31.4 or something like that, so to be a multiple fraction of pi, so I could start doing for seconds in a year and stuff like that, and be able to work out. And that's using that pi by 10 to the 7 seconds. At 1 meters per second, I could fairly quickly calculate, I think 20 million years off the top of my head, the number of years that you'd be walking if you started off walking at 1 meters per second, how long it would take for you to finally reach the end of your own DNA in your own body. It's quite staggering. And there's a few calculations like this, which gives you the scales of the universe, or the lengths, or the amount of the emptiness of the universe, is another fantastic thing to calculate. Now we come back here. I sort of remember that to simplify, I said that the DNA is a double helix, and it's coiled in a coil, another coil, and finally a super coil, super helix, to form the chromosome, that X-shaped object. Now, it can't, just by working it through, it can't sort of coil up and then in its coil form replicate. It has to replicate before it coils up, otherwise it's just too hard. It's got to sort of spit the two around. I'm going to have to give you some further information. So that's the simple idea of coil. But if you actually ever get a piece of string and try to do the double coil thing, what will happen is that when you pull out the string, you'll wind up and putting a huge twist in the string. So you would know that with garden hoses and stuff like that. If you just coil it up and don't put it in a figure eight, when you pull it up, it will put a twist in it. And so that's bad news for the DNA. And so this is a bit more in-depth view from molecular physics of the DNA. We'll also get into separation. So this is like a podcast. I really have to apologise that the podcast is broken up in two. I try and start off simple and start to, in the later aspects of the podcast, get into deeper aspects of it. So the DNA has the nucleic, so it's deoxynucleic acid DNA. I haven't got quite the pronunciation of it correct there. Okay, so you've got the backbone, which is phosphate and sugar, and that hooks into your base. Now your base connects to the other base at an angle, a twisted angle, and that twisted angle gives you the twist, the pitch of your DNA coil. So it's actually not really springy. It's actually, I suppose it is springy, but it is locked. Those bases lock together at a pitch, at an angle, and that gives you the oval spiral, double spiral staircase. Now, if you want to get a precursor of the double helix, there's a castle in France called Chambord Castle, a very big, over-designed castle designed by Leonardo da Vinci. And you go in it, and there's this double helix staircase. I think there's also a double helix in the Guggenheim. It's where you walk up, and you can walk up one staircase and not meet the other person who's on the other helix. But the pitch is defined by that. The other important aspect is that your phosphates and your phosphate is a highly has high electron affinity, i.e., it's a phosphorus and a couple of oxygens, and that has an ability to store or pull in electrons. And your sugar next to there can also be quite negative. Makes the acid a bit more acid, obviously, making that more positive, a bit more reactive, which is a good thing as far as the DNA is concerned. But it means the outer backbone of the DNA is highly negative. And so if you've got a whole lot of negative charges, they're quite repulsive, which is rather good. That means that if you have a DNA molecule in a confined space, it will spread out to fill that space, but keep a good space in between the next strand, so the strands actually repel each other at close range. And that aspect means that if you've got one piece of DNA poking itself into the next region of DNA in your nucleus, that little end of the DNA will be repelled backwards. Now, this is not... I haven't read this in the official papers. This is just... a series of thoughts about the dynamics of it. So you'll really have to check it out for yourself to validate that. This is just applying my fundamental logic to what's going on. And there's some papers I've read which links it together. Now, this negative backbone, when it's polarized negative backbone, is very important because it means that it does just mean that there's a DNA coil pressure which coils away against the nuclear wall, fills up the volume, and pushes keeps the actual chromosomes in their uncoiled states in confined regions, so because they repel each other, sort of rather than getting knotted. So if you had a lot of string in a drawer and stirred it around, it would become quite knotted unless the string repelled each other. Or look, say if you had string in a drawer and it was magic string, which when you put it had a force field around it, it would actually fill your drawer, and you'd be able to get in around the string. This is the amazing thing of DNA, because it's sprung out, it's got all this void in it which allows enzymes to whip in and do their stuff. And when the blueprints are lifted off it, the RNA, the messenger RNA, they're lifted off it and they're repelled, sort of made and then squirted out of the DNA. So it's a pretty amazing force to see it going on. This means that you can sprinkle the DNA with these histine. It's best to think of them as yo-yos. They're two-part. Are they enzymes? They're proteins. Enzymes is a somme, a ribosome, or an ase, carbolase. It's called an ase at the end of it. It's an enzyme, but these aren't enzymes. These are proteins. They've got a certain job to do, and there's a two-part yo-yo, and you just pump these into the DNA, hopefully the right amount. And so at a certain time, it starts producing this protein and pouring into the nucleus, and what happens is that this is positively charged. And what this does is it... The positively charged bits of the yo-yo go in, in different parts it coils around, and so it's on flat, and there's two halves of the yo-yo, and the two halves pull together and starts to wrap the DNA around itself in, wait for it, basically as best as we can do, a infibre figure eight, so clockwise one direction, anti-clockwise the other, and then locked together. And these group of yo-yos, I don't know how many forms a basic unit group of yo-yos, probably four or eight of them, come together with the DNA wrapped, I think it's twice around each of these yo-yos or biscuits. They're sort of flat, drum-like objects. And when I say flat, they're got a much larger radius than height, wraps around twice, spins out and wraps around the other way, and then wraps, and so you don't get this overall twist, which is one thing. So in essence, the DNA replicates, and it's not just free for all replication. There's a starting point pretty much in the middle of every chromosome. What the actual centre bit's called. I'll have to rethink of that. And so you put this in, and this does certain things. The positive charge of the histine, and again, I've read it a bit and looked at the actual molecule, and you can sort of understand for at least DNA that the backbone's negatively charged. And look, it's got to work this way, so it's hard to say. I wasn't actually going to do a podcast or talk to anybody else, so this is just raw information coming out, so please treat it with caution. So you've got the histine molecules, half yo-yos, which come in, stick to the DNA, forms full yo-yos and starts to coil it all at once. So it's not a process of the DNA coiling in one person, coiling it up at one end. These are coiling at millions of sites simultaneously, and within no time whatsoever, your nucleus, which had a huge amount of pressure on it, has no pressure at all, because that repulsive pressure of the DNA, repelling DNA, is gone, and it's formed into the chromosomes, which we recognise. So the chromosomes before, but now they're and the actual the uncoiled strand or fibre of DNA is called a chromid or something like that. But it forms these chromosomes, and these will, so so if you imagine your sock drawer full of different colours cottons, and you sprinkle magic dust in, and the cotton, rather than actually expanding and filling the whole drawer, comes up, and you'd be looking, it'd be hard to, it's not actually hard to look, they're actually quite big by the time they get in. You'll see the chromosomes going in. You'll see everything wound up, the yellow, the blue, the red. Now, they're actually not yellow, blue and red, but we can actually make them yellow, blue and red by adding dyes to them. We can actually dye our DNA with fluorescent dyes, so, i.e. a dye in a microscope is really hard to see, but you can actually shine it with a light and then pick up the light from. So you can imagine your drawer is really small. And that's the point where it's nice and easy to pick, and you can say, well, a big piece of DNA forms to a big chromosome, a smaller length goes to a smaller length chromosome. The X and the Y. Now, one of the things that people think, because all chromosomes are shaped like X's, they think that the Y has, this is a common student misconception, the Y has unequal legs. Now, the Y is just an alphabet region. Y, it's got the X sex chromosome have got equal amounts, while the boy has, I forgot what that, the central section where it's stuck together. So that's different. It's still an X, but there's two paths of eventually chopping off, and the boy ones. And boys are sledged to be evolved out. Eventually, will be evolved away. I don't know how that comes along. So the important point now is I may as well get on to DNA extraction. So there's a process. You get your strawberry, banana, kiwi fruit, beans, peas. There are certain ones which magically have more accessible DNA than others. I don't quite know the actual logic of it. You put it in salt and detergent, a certain amount of salt and detergent. I think the salt, for best results, is left uncompletely dissolved, because when you're grinding it in water and pestle, your combination of mortar and pestle, or I think there's other ones where you can put it in a plastic bag. So you put your mashed up, your blended banana or whatever it is, so it's all cut up, and you've got the individual cells in the salt and detergent, and you squish it around. You can squish it around in a bag if you don't want any mess. And the salt has two things. It's got a mechanical grinding aspect to it. Now, this is unofficial. People don't mention the grinding aspect, but it also has the effect. Salt has the ions which attract the water, which draws the water out of the membranes, and makes the cell membranes all floppy. So when they're floppy, they're easier to break. Someone else said that, it increases the water and causes the nuclear membrane to explode. I find this hard to actually believe that particular aspect. I think it just makes it everything floppy and easy to grind away. And so the moment you break the nuclear membrane, the DNA springs out. So you've got your mess of, say, kiwi fruit skins, things that you haven't molded up, all the double lipid layers, all the membranes there, and your... your DNA in this liquid, and you strain that through a Chuck's wipe. This is just something which will let the DNA and goop through. This is just to get the really heavy, big bits out, and so you get this. It's blended stuff. It's a bit soapy because it tastes soapy, and it's a bit salty. It goes into your test tube, and you have it there, and you observe it for a while, let it settle, maybe shake it once, tap it once or twice to get any bubbles out, get any bubbles to the top. And that's a bit of a amount. And then you get some chilled, and the colder, the better. Especially when I've got some dry ice or some liquid nitrogen, I use that to chill it. There's nothing worse. And of course, if you've got a large bottle of it, so it's best if you've got the drippers, and you put the drippers in the freezer for a while, because a bottle has got a large thermal mass. It takes a lot of time to chill down a large bottle. And the point is, then you introduce this by tilting your test tube at the side and running. Just carefully running the isopropanol down on the top layer, and at this time when you pour it in, just pour it in relatively quickly, a relatively thick layer, about 5 millimeters. 5 millimeters is good because when you observe it, you can see these, then you obviously can't see the strands of DNA, but the DNA is in this repulsive state and has found a more receptive receptacle for it, and it will actually snake its way up. You can actually see little DNA snakes going through the liquid, going up to the top, and it will form something remarkably similar to snot or mucus at the top, which you can then get a swizzle sticker, a small toothpick or skewer, and if you can pick up one bit, so it's best to actually fray the end a little bit, and then spin it. Because it's a fibrous thing, you can just get the whole clot out, and there's not much to see, but then I suppose what you would be doing is be able to estimate the length of the DNA snot that they've got out. Now, it turns out, just from observation, people who go for hammer and tong and really crush the stuff get worse results than people who just gently crush it and do it without a lot of effort. I don't know why that's so. That's just an observation of different students. I don't know the actual... mechanical view for it. Now, as I say here, you've done an estimate of the length of DNA and the length to the moon, and then you do this activity, and getting the understanding that the DNA, obviously with year 10 students, wouldn't go too much about the DNA repelling itself and aligning itself. So it's overall interesting. As for why it particularly likes going through cold isopropanol and how you can actually sit the isopropanol as a layer on top, I suppose the alcohol is less like an oil, less dense than water. But why it's the chilled aspect of it is necessary, I'm not exactly sure. So if I discover that reason why cold is more necessary, that would be a really worthwhile thing. But it is something that I notice that the chilled stuff, when it's really cold, and you look at it, you can actually see the DNA snake out. So the DNA is mixed with the water and all the other cell rubbish that's gone through, and it's got this. The energy on the surface of this DNA is enough to actually lift it up to the top. That's all I have to say for this. This will be a rather ramshackle podcast, and people will drag this out to say these podcasts are not up to standard. Look at the quality of it, but. It's a name between getting information out there, perhaps at lower quality, but to people who are interested in listening anyway and are not so high about the quality. I'll try and improve it next time. Thank you for listening. In the meantime, keep on doing science.